On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A big noise out of London yesterday on the global environment and the economy. A massive report from the head of Britain's Economic Service, former World Bank chief economist Nicholas Stern, in a study commissioned by Tony Blair, is saying the world is headed for economic meltdown equal to the last century's Great Depression and two world wars if it doesn't rein in global warming. Disaster in our lifetime, says Blair. The report's real target, the USA, the biggest polluter, with the British now all but begging for American leadership. In Washington, critics are sneering Chicken Little. Up next on Point, London's calling urgently on global warming. We'll hear from Nicholas Stern and more. First, joining me from London is Richard Black, environment reporter for the BBC. Richard Black, thanks for being with us. What's the push behind this big report? What's the motive in unloading this on the world?
Well, I think it initially came out of an initiative by the UK Chancellor of the Exchequer, that's the Finance Minister, Gordon Brown, who wanted to have an in-depth study for himself, quantifying the economic costs and benefits of tackling or not tackling climate change, because it was clearly an issue that was floating around. Should we deal with it now? Can we wait? He wanted to get someone with the authority of Sir Nicholas Stern to go through all the data and find what the conclusions were.
Give us the basic numbers. What's the case that Sir Nicholas Stern is making here?
Well, he pulls no punches here in his sober economist's language. Tackling climate change is the pro-growth strategy for the longer term, he says. And why is that? Well, he reckons that if we take measures to reduce our emissions of greenhouse gases and to protect some of the particularly poorer, more vulnerable countries against the impacts of climate change, that would amount to something in a cut of around about 1% of GDP. If we don't do anything, then by 2050, the middle of this century, we would be seeing reductions of around about 5 to 20% of global GDP. So in his view, the numbers stack up. Clearly, having a 1% loss is a lot better than having a 5 to 20% loss.
So diving in now to deal with global warming would put some drag on the economy, he's conceding, maybe 1%. But if we don't, he's saying 5 to 20% drag, he's equating that to the impact of two world wars and maybe the Great Depression. Where would that drag come from in the future? How does he describe that? What would cut future growth if this is not addressed in his view?
Well, there are quite a lot of uncertainties involved here, of course, but let me give you some of the things. First of all, you've got some of the physical impacts of climate change, such as, for example, a predicted increase in the intensity of hurricane wind speeds, a very controversial area scientifically, but I think over the last few months we've seen evidence emerge that this probably is the case. Now, he suggests that a 5 to 10% increase in hurricane wind speed, which is, you know, a consequence of rising sea temperatures, could double the annual damage costs to the USA.
Okay, so we've seen that in Hurricane Katrina here, and we could see a lot more of that. That's one piece. What else?
We're looking about a downturn in food production, particularly in the poorest countries. We're seeing effects on health with concomitant costs, of course, from that. We're seeing forced migration. We're seeing a degradation of water supplies. And particularly vulnerable areas here include vast tracts of Asia, which are fed via glaciers in the Himalayas, as areas like the Himalayas and the Andes and the Alps start to lose their glaciers. This would have a huge impact on water supplies. It's got to be made up somehow. So what Sir Nicholas has done is basically taken all of this physical data, all of these predictions, and turned them into an economic prediction of what the costs will be.
And those costs look very high. Again, he's equating them to something like the Great Depression or World Wars. What are the measures that he's proposing here to push back? What would they cost? What would they look like?
Well, it's a whole raft of measures, and some of them, he suggests, would actually give opportunities, would give economic opportunities. And clearly here we're talking about new technology, energy efficiency and new ways of generating electricity, new ways of getting around, that sort of thing, which is familiar to anyone who's really followed the climate change debate over the years. He's talking about adjusting the way perhaps that we grow crops, so we could look now at developing crops which would be more resistant to drought in areas of the world where drought is predicted, and more tolerant to flooding in areas of the world where flooding is predicted. This sort of thing, changing the way perhaps we build houses so that they would, in appropriate areas, be more resistant to hurricanes, to storms, this sort of thing. So a huge raft here of different types of investment.
And who's the audience for this report at large? I mean, the UK's economy is what? A couple of percent of the world economy. Is the British government here speaking to the world? Is it speaking to Washington?
It's a very good question. I think the primary aim was to provide figures for the British government, but of course it's mushroomed way beyond that now. Certainly the US is a key audience, and the British government has been talking to the US government for, well, at least 2 years. We could probably put in sort of 12 years here, about the importance of coming to the global table on climate change. The US, of course, produces more greenhouse gases than any other country. More importantly, its citizens produce per capita greenhouse emissions more than virtually any citizens of any other country. So the importance of getting the US into the process is certainly not lost on the UK. Beyond that, I think the audience is basically global finance ministers and global economists. And the argument here is it's all very well persuading environment ministers, but environment ministers don't really take decisions. The real decisions are taken by prime ministers and finance ministers. Now, there's really no one better qualified in the world to make these arguments from peer to peer than Sir Nicholas Stern. So I think that's the idea.
Right there from London, Centre of Finance, Richard Black, BBC reporter covering the environment. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
I want to turn now to the man behind the report that's turning a lot of heads. Joining us from London is Nicholas Stern, Sir Nicholas Stern. He is Chief of the Economic Service of the British Government, former Chief Economist at the World Bank, lead author of The Stern Review on the Economics of Climate Change, out yesterday. Nicholas Stern, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello. Hello, Tom. It's Nick Stern here.
Yes, great to have you. Speak first, if you would, to the level of urgency in this report. It's something beyond what we're accustomed to in an economics report. How would you describe the level of urgency that you're pointing to around global warming?
We argue that we've got 10 or 15 years to start on a strong new set of policies as a world. The reason for that is that carbon dioxide accumulates in the atmosphere, other greenhouse gases accumulate in the atmosphere, and it builds up, and it's very difficult to get it out. And that means that the later you leave it, the higher the level of stocks of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere you start from. Now, they have their effects with quite long lags, and with business as usual in carrying on as we are, in other words, we would build up to level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere of around 850 parts per million, roughly double where we are now, by the end of the century. And that would involve increases of temperatures of possibly 5 degrees centigrade or more, I guess 9 degrees Fahrenheit or more. And that would be really a very striking change in the world. It would rewrite the geography of the world. To get an impression of how big 5 degrees centigrade, 9 degrees Fahrenheit would be, it's the difference between where we are now and the last ice age 10,000 years ago, where, of course, where you could live would be very different from where you could live now. So those changes are very big. So what we've got to try to do is to slow down that build-up, slow down that build-up by cutting emissions.
We've seen images in Al Gore's movie and in other settings of what that world might look like, Nicholas Stern. At the physical level, you're looking, importantly here, at the economic impact. Help us understand what you're saying. Are you describing a world where you raise the Great Depression as a kind of equivalency here? Are you describing a world of global warming where everyone's going around with a tin cup, selling apples, standing on the street, selling pencils? Is it really that bad, worse?
No, I'm sorry. There's a fire alarm going off here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you fine. That sounds hot indeed. Can you stay at the microphone?
I think they're just testing. It's all right for me. No, I don't have to go away.
Okay.
But I hope your audience in the United States enjoys the safety procedures of the British government.
Sounds like it the Blitz. We're used to it.
It won't take long. But essentially what we're saying is that would involve a major disruption of economic activity and quite substantial economic losses. This is about risk, though. Nobody knows what the world's going to look like with certainty 50 or 100 or 150 years from now. But the problem is we can't avoid thinking about that directly because we know that the actions that we take now will affect the greenhouse gases and thus the temperatures that far into the future. So it's about limiting risk, this story, not predicting with precision, but about thinking through the kinds of risks you could head off by investing now in much lower carbon technologies. So that's the way in which we approach it. It's about reducing risk, and we describe that roughly, quantitatively, you could reduce the risks a great deal by holding back the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to 550 parts per million or lower, and that would cost you roughly 1% or so of GDP a year.
Of course, British Prime Minister Tony Blair was talking about it yesterday as well. After the presentation of the report by Sir Nicholas Stern, Blair offered a grim assessment of global warming if change doesn't come soon.
What is more, unless we act now, not sometime distant, but now, these consequences, disastrous as they are, will be irreversible. This issue is the definition of global interdependence. We have to act together. This is an international challenge, and in the end, only an international solution will meet it and overcome it.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Yesterday, the lead author of the report, Sir Nicholas Stern, joins us from London, former chief economist at the World Bank. Nicholas Stern, response from Washington already today. Of course, some very supportive, others very critical. I'm looking here at a report from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and I guess I should say they've taken a couple of million from Exxon in the last few years. Nevertheless, they say your report does not pass the laugh test, that this is Chicken Little stuff, quoting from one of their spokesmen, that you take worst-case scenarios, that you ignore the growth that will occur, that it's just not necessary, and B, it doesn't work even when you try.
Well, I did actually talk to the Competitive Enterprise Institute during a visit to Washington a few months ago, and I didn't find their analysis particularly convincing. What we've tried to do is to set out an analysis of the risks in a very careful way, using the literature, using the approaches that science has offered us now, which allows us to think through the probabilities. Previously, science just said, well, it might go like this or it might go like that. But the last few years has allowed us to take from the science some of the estimates of the risk. You know, what's the probability of it looking like this? What are the odds? Is it 1 in 10 it might look like this, or is it 3 in 10? And the science has helped us do that. So what we've done is to put that through a basic standard economic risk analysis, and that's what we've done. And I would invite the Competitive Enterprise Institute and anybody else to look carefully at what we've done and think it through. We've been careful and scholarly, in my view.
And finally, what does it mean if the United States does or does not kind of sign on to this view, get in line with you on addressing these issues now? Can your call to action be effective without full American participation?
We've argued that you can be green and grow if you do things differently. And I think that the United States could be a great leader in that, in showing how you can be green and grow by doing things differently, by using different kinds of technology where the United States has been a leader, and by using different kinds of price incentives, either taxes or carbon trading, that give you a price for carbon. Again, the United States has been a leader on this. In sulfur dioxide, the trading scheme was pioneered by the United States. So if you look at the market mechanisms that are going to sort this out, and if you look at the technology that's going to sort it out, I think the United States has got a pretty good track record. If you look at the northeastern United States, if you look at California, they're making strong moves in these directions. And the United States stands to suffer like any other country. Florida is vulnerable to rising sea levels. A lot of the southern United States is vulnerable to the much greater intensity hurricanes that would come. the Sierra Nevada snows are likely to go as temperature goes up, and that would put California under even greater water stress. The United States has been pioneering in the methods for dealing with this problem. It stands to lose like anybody else, and it's a crucial element because it is, as a big country and a rich country, the biggest emitter. So I think the United States has very good reason to come in. I think it would make a very big difference. Indeed, it's crucial the United States comes in, and I believe that people are thinking these things through. And I think that if you look at the way in which the argument's developing, if you look out into the way United States is going, I think it's very likely that United States can join in and, in fact, be a leader on this.
So there's the word, the alarm, the plea from London from Sir Nicholas Stern, lead author of the big new report on global warming and its economic consequences, chief of the Economic Service in the United Kingdom. Nicholas Stern, thanks very much for joining us.
Nice to talk to you, Tom, and sorry about the firearms we had in the building.
Not at all. It's life.
I hope you enjoyed them at your end.
Life as we know it. They sound a little different. Thanks for bringing us that. Something special. Nicholas Stern there. I want to join to invite in a couple more voices from the UK now. First, from Cambridge, England, we're joined by Michael Grubb, Senior Research Associate in the Economics Department at Cambridge University, Chief Economist at the UK Carbon Trust, Editor-in-Chief of the journal Climate Policy. Michael Grubb, thank you for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
And
thank
also,
you for the invite.
It's great to have you. Also with us from London, Emma Duncan, Deputy Editor at The Economist magazine, we'd say. She wrote a special report on global warming for The Economist recently. Emma Duncan, thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Michael Grubb, first to you. How do you judge the significance of this report? It's very big. It brought the Prime Minister out and, of course, Nicholas Stern, no mean advocate. What's the significance of the alarm-ringing big report out of the UK?
Well, I think it's a report with huge significance, partly because of the sheer authority behind it, as I think you've laid out in your opening of this program, and indeed the welcome that it got both from the Prime Minister and from our Chancellor, or the Finance Minister. But also I think that the, you know, buried in these 700 pages and the enormous amount of analysis that's gone into it, there's really two very fundamental things I think that it's saying. I think first, the report is really closing a huge gap that's existed for 15 years between the scientific community, which has been expressing concern for a very long time, and an economics community which has been very sceptical and asking, you know, really do the benefits of acting outweigh the costs and so forth. And essentially, the report has concluded that when you do the economics thoroughly and rigorously, you take account of the full range of scientific evidence, you use the right kind of tools to weight the economic impact and the human impact, then yes, you do conclude that this issue is very serious, it is very urgent, that there is a need for quite strong precautionary action from a cost-benefit standpoint. Scientists have been saying that for a long time. This is by far the most weighty economic analysis to say so. I think the other fundamental thing the report is saying is that tackling the problem is not only something that, you know, the costs will well pay for themselves through the reduced impacts, but it's something that is going to have to involve carbon pricing, which effectively caps on carbon emissions that generate a price, and in addition, supplementary, very important additional measures around both technology and behaviour and energy efficiency, so forth. But that it puts the centre stage on carbon pricing and carbon cap and trade type schemes and on actually limiting emissions.
Emma Duncan, your publication has come out and said this is first and foremost a call out to the United States to get on board, almost a plea for American leadership. Why so public? Why this way? Has it not worked in the back room? Is this Britain sort of breaking out of the old boys' club to make such a public statement?
Well, I said it's that because Tony Blair takes a pretty gorish view on climate change.
As in Al Gore.
He sees it as a legacy issue for himself to try to get the global ball rolling again. And his view, I think, is that in Washington, there is quite a strong argument, which you don't much hear made in Europe these days, that to try to combat climate change would be too expensive, that the costs of doing so are simply not worth the effort. And I think also in Washington, often this view gets rolled up with a sense amongst some on the right that attempts to get America to cap its carbon emissions are part of some socialist conspiracy to undermine the American way of life. And I think that Tony Blair wanted the British government to have some solid material to hand to try to counter those arguments. And Sir Nicholas has certainly offered that material because he is weighing up the costs of trying to do something about climate change against the costs that climate change may impose on the world economy. And he finds the costs of doing something about it at 1% of global GDP as against the costs possibly of climate change at 5 to 20% of global GDP. And there it's a no-brainer. So he's saying, in effect, that if you want to protect the American way of life, then do something about climate change.
Michael Grubb, how about it? Nicholas Stern, as Emma Duncan says, sees it as a no-brainer that it's worthwhile. On the other hand, you know the kind of criticism this will get from some quarters in the United States. Here again from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, they're saying that his estimates for what it will cost to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to this extent are laughably rosy. They don't pass the laugh test. Do they look reasonable, realistic, these costs attendant to bringing down the advance of global warming?
Well, I think they're realistic if you make two assumptions, one of which is that we do live in a world of enterprise and in which, given the right signals, companies do innovate. They don't sit there and do nothing and say, gee, energy's getting more expensive, we'll just pay the bill. The companies come forward with lower carbon technologies, lower carbon solutions. Companies look better at their efficiency of their operations. And I think that's a very reasonable starting point. I think the very high costs of limitations are essentially assuming dumb companies, dumb technologies that just sit there in the face of a problem. The other thing is it does assume that there is a global effort behind this. And I think that's part of the plea being mapped out. It's that the cost of tackling climate change can be very small, providing we all pull together. And I think, as Emma says, that one of the focuses of this report is to try and create that common understanding and common recognition.
I want to begin to bring our listeners in, if I may, calling us from Washington, D.C., Josiah. Josiah, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello. I've also seen Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if the 1% GDP is enough with the catastrophes that we saw in Katrina and the tsunami and things that I think are going to be increasing incredibly, aside from a political issue in any way, is 1% even enough to turn things around?
There's the straight-up question, and it goes to the economic argument. Emma Duncan, we've heard what Michael Grubb has to say there. Is this seen as sufficient? Is Nicholas Stern, you know, painting the whole picture here? Would 1% cost to GDP cover it?
A lot of people think that's reasonable. What Sir Nicholas is saying that would do is to stabilize carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas equivalent concentrations in the atmosphere at 550 parts per million. Mm. We're at about 400 now. Some people doubt that that is low enough. And I think, Michael, you may feel that things need to be held down below that. But 1% of global GDP would probably be enough to stabilize at that sort of level. And many scientists think we could just about live with that.
Let me get a call from Dubuque, Iowa. Frank is on the line. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Just had a question as far as the recent, I guess, recent to me anyway, development as far as permafrost releasing the emissions into the atmosphere, and with that being more of a natural thing.
So nature itself really contributing to global warming as the planet warms once the permafrost starts to melt, yes?
Is there no going back? Is it going to happen? Should we put all of our effort into, I guess, the housing, making the houses ready for this phenomenon to happen?
Got it. Michael Grubb, how about it? Should we instead be concentrating on, I don't know, orange groves in Canada and, you know, just simply changing and adapting to global warming rather than trying to forestall it at this point?
Well, I think one of the things that's very clear is that we're going to have to do some adaptation to climate change. There's roughly every 5 years there's a major global assessment, and there's no question the last couple such assessments and the current one are pointing to the fact that climate is already changing. It's changing faster than we expected, and there's several more, frankly, decades of change already pent up because of past emissions and the inertia in our systems. So I don't think anyone's disputing that there's got to be some adaptation to climate change. I think what is clear, and I think what the Stern report emphasises, is that the longer one delays, or the weaker that action tackling emission, the more unmanageable those kind of problems become, and the greater the risk of the kind of feedbacks that I think the questioner was referring to, namely that there are some things that go on in the planet that start to feedback on itself, the melting of the permafrost that releases methane. I know one of the scenarios that really scares the UK Met Office is the potential collapse of the Amazonian rainforest. If it starts drying out, if the forest becomes unstable, that could release vast quantities of carbon into the atmosphere, and you don't get the Amazon back once you've lost it, because the whole area would dry out. So there's scary scenarios out there, and that's one of the things that Sir Nicholas is pointing to, the need to stay in safer regions.
Emma Duncan, you know, American critics will say, well, these efforts are not working so far. Europe has not shown the way. The U.S., of course, didn't end up signing, under George Bush, did not sign on to Kyoto Protocol. Big meeting coming up there in Nairobi, Kenya. But you've got critics saying Europe signed up, and yet they haven't hit the marks. It's not working. So, you know, that it's all a kind of fantastic idea that you can write a charter and fix this.
Europe's system, emissions trading system, isn't working very well. That's absolutely true. But we're at a very early stage of dealing with this problem. You know, what the world was trying to do with Kyoto, what America, I think, sadly walked away from, was an effort just to get a global push going on this thing. It's incredibly hard to deal with this problem. It crosses boundaries. It crosses generations. It's terribly uncertain because the science is so complicated. And if we're to deal with it, we need to get the institutions going that can help us properly rein this thing back in the future. So I don't think that the critics who say, look, you've tried and you've failed, have really got their finger on the button. I think the really important thing is to get an effort going, and then maybe over time we can really get down to reining back emissions.
We've been joined from London by Emma Duncan, deputy editor at The Economist there, and Michael Grubb is with us, senior research associate in the economics department at Cambridge University. He says the new report is bridging the realms of science and economics for the first time. Michael Grubb, I heard you wanted to come in there on costs and efficacy.
Well, I just wanted to echo Emma's point that tackling climate change has started, and that in a fairly big way. And that on the back of that, we're learning and moving forward. What essentially has happened in Europe is that about a year and a half ago, we started operation of the European Emissions Trading Scheme, effectively cap and trade of European emissions. It's basically a US idea. It's the system that you use in sulfur regulation, but it's been applied for the first time to carbon in Europe. And I think we've seen many things. The carbon price has fluctuated quite a lot, but it has also driven a lot of corporate response. And one hears a lot, for example, from the cement industry about things they've done to cut emissions in the face of this. The other key element of it, though, is that this is set within the context of the Kyoto targets that European countries have signed up to. They're at varied stages in terms of how much of that they're going to meet domestically, for example, through this trading scheme. And the balance is something that they have to invest in developing country emission reduction projects, so that what you see now is a lot of these European companies getting involved in emission reduction investments in developing countries, and obviously trying to promote some of their own lower carbon technologies along with that. So there's quite a bit of money already beginning to flow under these kinds of systems, as well as learning and how to improve on it in the next round of allocations.
Let me bring in an American voice, if I may, for some perspective from this side of the Atlantic. Andrew Revkin joins us from New York. He's environment reporter for the New York Times, author of the book about climate change, The North Pole, was here. Andrew Revkin, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
So you heard the big noise out of London yesterday. You've been writing in this long series in the Times about energy and options and the future here. How do you see this claim and almost plea from London factoring into the American debate around the way forward on global warming?
Well, as everyone has been saying, it isn't just an American response that's needed. The developing world is where the brunt of emissions are going to come from, first of all, and they're also sort of sitting on the sidelines, and clearly they're waiting for the U.S. to act before a country like China will step forward. There's several great paradoxes in all of this. A cap-and-trading system like Kyoto, according to most of the economists I talk to, can only really work if there are technological options that suit the emissions cuts that are needed under the cap. And one reason Europe is having a hard time switching gears is because it's still, overall, still cheaper to grow and emit the emissions from existing options than to switch to pushing for technologies that take solar or wind or whatever the non-emitting option is to the next level.
And just remind us, on a cap and trade, this is where there's a limit on how much global warming emission any company can have. If you exceed it, you've got to kind of buy credits from companies that are below it.
Right. And the only kind of cap that can work, and Kyoto is the very first little preliminary baby step, and maybe even somewhat of a misstep in the way it was designed toward what economists say would be necessary to actually shift the world away from more and more greenhouse gases. What's needed is a cap that would grow stronger and broader and be predictable, meaning that you wouldn't have a periodic renegotiation, which is what we will eventually inevitably have. That's what's happening in Nairobi starting next week, on what comes after Kyoto. If it's always kind of uncertain whether the world has committed to a century-long ramping down of emissions, then industry and those with money to invest aren't likely to put it in places that will matter.
Andrew Rifkin, Al Gore said at the end of his movie, An Inconvenient Truth, we already know everything we need to know to effectively address this problem. You've written just in the last couple of days that that's not true, that the technology is not out there yet to bring alternate energy fully on stream to support the world economy. Does this 1% of GDP cost of getting out of the global warming trap sound reasonable to you, or given the research that still needs to be done, does it sound short?
Well, it's the Stern Report only takes things through till 2050, and one of the problems here, and I interviewed people involved with it yesterday, one of the problems is that the heavy lifting, the real heavy lifting, comes after 2050. So, and some economists say that 1% of GDP is an understatement of what most people anticipate the cost to be even to get to stabilize the emissions. That means every year the amount is not growing anymore. But what needs to be done to stabilize the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is a very different question. This stuff adds up like unpaid credit card debt,
right,
you know.
Right.
It doesn't go away if you turn off the faucet. What has to be done to take that curve and not just slow the rise but bend it downward is an enormous cost. Well, let's put it this way. The only way to do it without an enormous cost is with fundamentally new technology.
Technology that you're writing is not fully there now. Emma Duncan.
Yeah, and by the way, as Al Gore recently in a speech at NYU, he kind of amended his movie and said what he's saying is we have the technologies we need to get started on solving the problem. So he's made a very substantive kind of reality-based adjustment to his rhetoric.
Emma Duncan, is even the British report sort of pushing our full awareness of the cost out there to make it more politically palatable, economically palatable now, Emma?
I don't really think so. I mean, a lot of people have run the figures on the costs of doing something about climate change before, and those figures are easier to assess than the costs of climate change itself, because we know the price of some alternative technologies that already exist. And there isn't a huge difference right now, for instance, between the price of generating electricity through wind and generating it through gas. So I don't find his one percentage figure implausible, no.
Emma Duncan at The Economist. I know we have to let you go. I want to thank you very much for spending a few minutes with us today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let me take a call from John in Manassas, Virginia. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to say something about something that's very dear to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a grandfather, and I got my third grandchild on the way, and I'm always very, very concerned about what their future may be. And I think it's sad that America, you know, really the premier country power of the world, is really not putting its best foot forward. And as American, I don't care if it costs 1% or 2% or 3%. If it's going to give us a chance, I mean, truly just a chance, to you know, stabilize the environment so that our future can enjoy what we've enjoyed, then I think it should be spent, well spent.
So you don't mind if it's 1 or 2 or 3% that starts to get expensive, but what about the country as a whole? Do you see it on the right path, the U.S. now, John? And if not, why not?
Unfortunately, I don't see it, going on the right path. I mean, there are a lot of individuals, you know, throughout the country that are promoting, protecting our environment. But unfortunately, those with the power and in our government, those in business, they aren't doing what they should be doing. Take a look at what what was it, BP? They're advertising being green, and we just had the problems with the pipeline.
Up on the North Slope in Alaska. Yeah, John, yeah. We hear it. We hear it loud and clear. Michael Grubb, how about it? It's been, in many dimensions, a moral argument about global warming to this point. Now, you're saying the bridge has been built here with this report to the economic argument. Do you think that might be more effective in prompting response?
I think it might be. That's certainly the intent of the study that was launched yesterday. And it seems to me there's actually quite a few bridges that need building here, not just between the science and the environment. But I was rather struck. It does, if I understood properly, Andy Revkin's world seemed a little bit black and white, that either we do or we don't have the technologies. Well, we've got a vast array of technologies that are going to need to be used to crack this problem. Some of the very long-term deep reductions, I'm sure, will involve things that we haven't thought of. There's a lot that can be done in the shorter term, using technologies that are very well and visible. Some of them are very cost-effective. Some of them require a bit more economies of scale. I think the place that the Stern Report positions itself in terms of the real focus being on deep reductions by 2050, around 60% reductions from present levels, feels
huge.
To me about right. It's something that can be met with technologies that are known, but by no means all of them are proven and commercial at scale. Going beyond that, maybe we're getting into territory that we really don't know. But frankly, getting out to 2050 and deep reductions, I think, is a good focal point. But again, the fact that this is a long-term problem, which nobody disputes, still leaves me mystified as to why people criticize Kyoto for being a first step. I don't know of any long journey that doesn't get there without starting with a first step. And I think one just very brief reaction from this side of the pond, if you like, on John's comment. I actually share his puzzlement. I've been involved and watched the US debate for a long time, and I grew up thinking the US is very much a can-do society. And I'm just very puzzled that there's so many people saying can't do. It's just very strange to me.
Do you see the United States as an ally or an enemy on addressing global warming?
Oh, I think we see the US as a very complicated place where there are a lot of different actors pushing in lots of different directions. I think what is significant, to come back to one of the questions you asked, Emma, was this report targeted at Washington? My reading now is 4 years ago the UK effort was targeted at Washington, and that largely now there's been an element of giving up on Washington per se, but a recognition that the US is a big country and there are many, many other places that are interested in a serious dialogue about how we solve this problem.
With you or without you, if that's possible, Sharon's calling from Colton's Point, Maryland. Hi, Sharon, you're on the air.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that if we spend the money and invest in alternative energies, which we know how to do right now, and Sir Stern is wrong, we'll be stuck with all that clean air, a new industry, and a lot of new jobs. What is the downside of doing what he suggests?
So never mind the cost. It looks all like upside to you. Sharon, thanks for the call. Andrew Revkin?
Yeah.
Two things there. First of all, Sharon, like many others, believes we know the path. Let's just do it. You're kind of saying, well, no, we haven't put the research into this. We don't know how to do this yet. And the idea that this could be actually cost-free, that it would be a net gain, true?
Well, one thing that I note in my story in the Energy Challenge series is that there's a potential threefer here. That Roger Bezdek and other experts studying this have pointed out that we face three energy challenges in the 21st century, not one. And climate being one, the surging demand and unavoidable and appropriate demand for abundant energy in developing economies. And then the third one is the end of easy, cheap oil. And all of these things can lead to disruption and cost, and one thing can address all of them, which is essentially putting energy front and center as one of the keystone challenges of this century. And it involves kind of an all-of-the-above approach. As, you know, there's no real disagreement among those who are studying this that I've found on the idea that if you invest in advancement, deployment, demonstration at larger scale, and basic research on the farther-flung ideas in energy, there's very little downside to that.
But let's get going, you're right, because we're not there yet. Let me get one more call from Boston. Ted's on the line. Hi, Ted.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well.
I'm a business owner here in Boston. My family owns and operates hotels like the Lenox, and we have taken simple measures. I'm always puzzled by this notion that we have to take draconian measures, change our entire way of life in order to accomplish these goals. And we've taken simple measures which have had significant impacts on our energy consumption, on our energy costs, and on our climate change impact. Things like putting in good thermostats, programmable thermostats, good lighting throughout the building, even in decorative lighting, there's now all sorts of options, timers. And now we're actually at the point where we've reduced our energy consumption to the point where we are buying enough renewable energy credits to offset all of our electricity at our Boston hotel.
That sounds pretty great. So step up, do some conservation, put in the technology that's there right now, and you can have an impact. But Michael Grubb, let me ask you, in the UK, you're talking 60% reduction in these emissions by 2050. Our caller says it doesn't have to be draconian, but that sounds like a radical reduction. Does it mean a different face on our economies, our lives?
Well, it's a big journey. But I think that we can see roughly how to get there, not in the real micro detail. But I think the broad elements are pretty clear. It involves a significant big increase in the efficiency of the UK economy, the kind of measures the previous caller referred to, but at much wider scale. The Carbon Trust that I work for half-time as chief economist, its primary mission is to help UK business improve its energy efficiency in that kind of way. And very often we find the companies are coming back for more because it actually turns out to be good for their business. It reduces their exposure to energy costs, energy uncertainties, and to develop a low-carbon industry sector. And again, a whole raft. We, you know, floated two fuel cell companies, and there's a lot of ideas out there at a commercializable stage that are coming forward. And I think the 60% reduction, yeah, it involves a power system that looks very different from the one we've got at the moment. It involves more distributed sources. It involves more transmission to ship renewable energy and other sources around. But the engineers that work on power systems and the technologies available are very confident that we can get there. But it requires a push and it requires incentives. There's no questions. Some of the bits are trickier. Transport is trickier. We've got hybrid cars that maybe could get us halfway there. Going further gets harder. I'm not saying one has all the solutions, but I think the pitch in the Stern report of that kind of reduction is the right place to be aiming for, and I think we can see roughly how to get there.
Andrew Rifkin, we've just got half a minute. Here's a big call. How will we know when and if the United States is stepping up to this challenge? What will be the evidence?
This relates a little bit to the question the questioner earlier, who was a grandfather too. I've been writing about this for 20 years for grown-ups, and I finally wrote a book on climate for the next generation.
Kids,
I'm not.
Right.
It's a huge transition we're talking about in terms of public will. The thing that is not there, and this is not just restricted to the United States. Studies beneath the surface in the UK and elsewhere too say people have not yet integrated clearly that essentially for the rest of the fossil fuel era, we need to transition progressively toward an emissions-free world if we're going to have a stabilized climate. And that requires education, it requires moving mountains in the end, and that really does require beyond efficiency gains, especially in a world going to 9 billion people, all of whom want to live like us, a revolution.
Right. Now, Andrew Rifkin at the New York Times, thank you for joining us, and Michael Grubb at Cambridge University, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.